hopefully we didn't get anything on that plane. We're just kind of ticking the days by to make sure we're healthy. But on the plane, I wasn't too worried.
Evacuation from Wuhan. It's Thursday, February 13th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard here in Washington. Also ahead, the U.S. presidential campaign officially off and running, debating war powers in the U.S. And ever wonder where your computer data goes? Well, we've got a pretty good guess. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Starting today, the 2020 presidential race is, well, off to the races. Voters went to the polls in the first in the nation primary in New Hampshire on Tuesday. But were the results any clearer than just a week ago in Iowa? Well, joining us now is senior national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, I know you've seen many of these contests come and go. What can you tell us about what happened on Tuesday in New Hampshire?
This is a pretty interesting one, Doug, because you have a winner in Bernie Sanders, who actually won it 4 years ago, but by a much bigger margin against Hillary Clinton at that time. So you've got Bernie Sanders camping out in what we call the progressive lane of the party, but you've got a number of moderates really competing to be the one that sort of does a standoff with him as we move through the primaries. And we've got a bit of a lull now until Nevada and South Carolina later this month. And then we get a huge amount of primaries in many states into mid-March.
Well, first to these other competitors who were pulling close with Senator Sanders, Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Amy Klobuchar, I think both did surprisingly well.
Yes. I mean, Buttigieg came close to catching Sanders. A lot of people would have been very surprised at that. He had a very strong race coming out of Iowa. And then Klobuchar, of course, was another big surprise for the evening. She'd been lagging in single digits in the polls, and she really sort of shot up into third place, and at the expense of two other candidates, Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren. And both of them now are trying to find a way they can keep going.
Could Buttigieg and Klobuchar perhaps be splitting this more moderate vote that would be, you know, in opposition or in contrast to Senator Sanders?
I think so. And if you added up the totals of the so-called moderate candidates from New Hampshire and include Joe Biden in that mix, it's over 50%. So you can see that Sanders is benefiting from this split vote among the moderates. That could even become more of a split with Michael Bloomberg now looming in the coming weeks in the Super Tuesday states with a lot of money. So Bloomberg also coming from the centrist wing of the party.
We've seen one or two candidates already, if not drop out, announce their, quote, suspending their campaign. I kind of dislike that phrase, but that's what they're saying. They're suspending their campaign. Two people who aren't suspending their campaigns are former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Warren, who, you know, not to put a value judgment on it, but I think the results were poor.
They were, especially if you consider that Warren is from neighboring Massachusetts.
Exactly.
And she got, you know, in the single digits. It's not a great showing. And she was at the top of the heap just a few months ago, then put out a very detailed health care plan, and that caused her to lose support. So the thing is, what's the reason now for any of these folks to get out of the race right now? It's sort of muddled. It's complicated. There is no clear sort of front runner who's shooting up to the top of the polls and bringing much of the party with them. You have Bernie Sanders in that progressive lane, and you have the other folks jockeying to sort of take him on one-on-one.
Just for the benefit of our listeners, I think there were about 62 delegates allocated yesterday from the New Hampshire primary. It takes 1,991 to win the Democratic primary. Are we making simply way too much of these very early contests?
Well, very often the early contests do point the way toward a smaller field in the case of Iowa, and often toward the winner in terms of New Hampshire. No nominee has, for the Democrats, has ever finished below second. So we'll see if this is the year that breaks that mold. But there's also a lot of people calling for changes in the system, get more diverse states in earlier to have a voice in this process. So that debate will go on, I think, for the next few years.
Last question, very quickly. I know it was a long night for you. What are you looking to happen? What are you looking at in this next, say, month period? That's really going to maybe kind of be an indicator of where we're going.
Can Joe Biden mount a comeback? That would be in South Carolina. Can Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg continue their rise? And what of Michael Bloomberg? What impact will he have on the race? And will Bernie Sanders be able to expand his appeal to the party more broadly?
Senior national correspondent Jim Malone, what would we do without you? Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Cleric Hafez Hasid, the man accused of masterminding a deadly attack on Mumbai, India, more than a decade ago, has been convicted in neighboring Pakistan in two terrorism-related cases. Leaders in Afghanistan say the United States has made notable progress in ongoing peace talks with representatives of the Taliban. And India took more than 20 foreign diplomats on a visit to disputed Kashmir on Wednesday, the second such trip since Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government stripped the region of semi-autonomous status. You can learn much more by going to our website, voanews.com. And VOA Asia continues. What has been called the Wuhan coronavirus now has an official name, COVID-19. It also has a body count, more than 42,000 people infected and more than 1,000 deaths in China alone. The epicenter city of Wuhan remains under guarded quarantine, but governments around the world are working to get foreign nationals out. Among them is Johnny Dangerfield, an American national who was recently evacuated from Wuhan, currently in quarantine in the Midwest of the United States. He told VOA's Adriana Zhang that the flight home was a bit dicey.
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't say worried, but vigilant. Everyone was wearing masks, and they gave us new masks every few hours. So we had clean masks all the time. So that made us feel a little bit better. I just not so much worried, but just extra vigilant. Like, okay, let's make sure surfaces are clean. You know, don't touch your face. You know, wash your hands when you can. Or we didn't have running water on the plane, but we had hand sanitizer, so we were sanitizing quite a bit. Actually wasn't too worried on the plane. Of course, a little bit. You're always a little bit concerned, but it's at this point, you know, a few days into quarantine, now we're just kind of hoping, okay. Hopefully, we didn't get anything on that plane. We're just kind of ticking the days by to make sure we're healthy. But on the plane, I wasn't too worried.
So we have to revisit this question, because this question I asked in our previous interview, but I still want to know, like, how do you think about what the Chinese government is doing this time?
Yeah.
Are you satisfied? Are you worried? Do you think they should improve? Or
I am. I mean, I feel in general the Chinese government has been pretty forthcoming, pretty transparent. I mean, the information as far as cases and mortality rate does seem, I mean, it seems pretty accurate. At the same time, I am still concerned at a few things as far as from the Chinese government's perspective. One is how long it's taken them for them to accept outside help on this. I mean,
it's been reported, you know, for weeks, the WHO was offering to send representatives, and only until, you know, recently, I think this week, did, you know, a team get to Beijing. It wasn't until just this week, I believe, or recently that the WHO was allowed to come in. And I know representatives from the CDC, you know, for weeks have been offering to assist, and their efforts have been apparently rebuffed by the Chinese government. Now, I don't know exactly all the details, but that definitely concerns me. It seems like the Chinese side or the government wants to kind of handle this on their own. And which I can understand, but is just disappointing. So I wish in these types of situations that governments like the Chinese government could be a little bit more humble and accepting of outside help like that. I mean, the relation of the Sino-U.S. relationship is just still at a point where there's just barbs going back from either side. And I mean, the U.S. has given a lot of help to the Chinese government, but you know, they're not going to they have been slow to really acknowledge that openly. And so, you know, we get friends like on WeChat, you know, sharing articles like, oh, the U.S. has done nothing or hasn't done anything. And then, but then you also get people on WeChat are sharing like, no, actually the U.S. has done a lot of stuff. So there still are good voices on either side, but, I am definitely concerned about one, that aspect of not receiving help. And just one other thing here is that, that I'm concerned about is just, I mean, the fact that, you know, from my perspective, China as a government, I mean, they have gone through so much international humiliation in the, you know, centuries before, and now they've kind of come back to this to this attitude of we're very strong and, you know, we're not going to be bullied by other countries and we can stand on our own 2 feet, that kind of pride can be very dangerous. And it makes me wonder, it does make me wonder as far as how accurate the numbers they are giving us. And so if like an independent organization like the WHO or could come in, or even the CDC as well, if we could have other organizations coming in and confirming, you know, the process and the numbers, that would definitely make me feel better. And, you know, if the U.S., if the shoe was on the other foot, if this was in the United States, you know, I would hope that, because, I mean, you don't necessarily have to be an authoritarian government to say, you know, I want to look good and look like I got a handle on this. So if this was on the U.S.'s side of things, the U.S. was the epicenter, I'd hope that the U.S. would be, you know, open to having independent organizations confirm things. And, you know, of course, we have an independent press here, which is something, you know, you don't have in China as well. So, yeah, that's kind of my main concerns.
Phoenix Financial Executive Johnny Dangerfield speaking with VOA Mandarin's Adriana Zhang. Happening now in Asia, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party suffered a humiliating defeat in a prestigious election for the local government in the capital of New Delhi, the first held since widespread protests erupted against a new law that critics say is anti-Muslim. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news alert from VOA Asia, angry inmates set fire to an overcrowded prison on Indonesia's Sumatra Island during a riot that erupted on Wednesday. Hundreds of police and soldiers were deployed to take control of the prison, which is designed to house 193 inmates. This is VOA Asia. And this news break from VOA Asia, the recent death of a Chinese doctor who was detained by police for exposing the coronavirus has brought renewed concern about another medical professional. Since April of last year, authorities have restricted the movements of Zhang Yongyang, who exposed the government's cover-up of the SARS epidemic in 2003. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. The U.S. Senate will vote this week on a resolution aimed at restricting President Donald Trump from taking military action against Iran without congressional authorization. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who sponsored the resolution, says he intends to prevent another U.S. military engagement in the Middle East. On Tuesday, senators on the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee heard testimony on the state of the American engagement in Afghanistan, the longest military conflict in history. VOA's Ardita Dunalari has that story.
To order this hearing.
U.S. Senators listened as John Sopko, the nation's top Inspector General for U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan, delivered a grim report. The U.S. effort is failing to meet major objectives and overall lacks transparency, he said, in part because of stonewalling by Afghan authorities and U.S. agencies attempting to cover up failures and mismanagement.
Every time we find something that looks like it's going negative, it gets classified or it's no longer relevant.
As a result, Sopko said Congress and the American public aren't getting an accurate picture of U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan.
I can't tell you publicly how well a job we're doing on training. So those $64 billion has gone for training and assisting the Afghan military. And I can't tell you or the American people. And that's in part because we allow the Afghan government to classify what I can tell you.
Richard Boucher, former Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia during the Bush administration, described it as a failed strategy to build a stable governance based on a misguided understanding of realities on the ground.
But overall, we failed and still failed to build stability because we failed to empower the Afghan government to deliver the benefits of government to Afghans at the local level.
The Afghanistan engagement serves as an important lesson in the war on terror, said Ambassador Boucher.
We need to lead with diplomacy backed by a military capability, not the other way around. And most importantly, we need to fund diplomacy so that America can lead.
The former diplomat added that U.S. intervention in Afghanistan has run its course.
In my view, it's time to come home.
As the race for the White House heats up, there is a renewed talk about ending the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. In his State of the Union address, President Donald Trump repeated his promise to end America's wars in the Middle East. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate will vote Wednesday on a resolution sponsored by Democratic Senator Tim Kaine to limit the president's ability to order military action without congressional authorization. The measure originated out of concern that President Trump may conduct military strikes against Iran after U.S. troops killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is calling on members of the chamber to defeat the resolution, saying that it would severely limit the U.S. military's operational flexibility to defend itself against threats posed by Iran. Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
A U.S. Taliban peace deal could be signed this month if the Taliban significantly reduces violence. That deal could lead to the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Now, this all comes from two Afghan government sources and a Western diplomat speaking to Reuters News. The talks had been deadlocked in part over U.S. demand that the insurgents agree to significantly reduce violence as part of any American troop withdrawal accord.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences are reporting that they have discovered a giant stellar black hole in our Milky Way galaxy. The discovery came as a big surprise to the Chinese astronomers. Lead astronomer Liu Jifeng says that according to most current models of stellar evolution, black holes of such mass should not even exist in our galaxy. The huge stellar black hole has been named LB1. It has a mass 70 times greater than the Sun and is located 15,000 light years from Earth. Scientists currently list four types of black holes: stellar, intermediate, supermassive, and miniature. Stellar black holes are formed by the gravitational collapse of a star, and until this discovery, stellar black holes had a mass of no more than 20 times that of the Sun. The discovery was reported in the journal Nature. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Finally, have you ever stored something in the cloud and wondered where exactly that data goes? Well, you might be surprised to learn it's in a quiet residential community about 30 miles outside the capital city of Washington, where people jog or walk their dogs around human-made lakes. Children's teams practice on soccer fields, and teens play pickup basketball on community courts. VOA's Dora McCour reports.
While thousands of families moved in to live and play in this bedroom community, the town of Ashburn in Loudoun County, Virginia, quietly became home to the most dense fiber network anywhere in the world.
It's amazing when you think about the amount of fiber that's in the ground. We have both sides of the road pretty much have fiber troughs in them, and now we're putting some fiber in the middle of the roads as well.
70% of the world's internet traffic passes through all of that fiber. That's why Ashburn is known as Data Center Alley, the Silicon Valley of the East. Pretty much any email sent or received anywhere around the globe comes this way. If you've got something stored on the cloud, it's probably in one of these data centers.
The cloud is based somewhere, and by and large, the cloud has been based here in Loudoun County, Virginia, in the data centers, the 18 million square feet of data centers that we have on the ground here.
AOL, America Online, was among the first to move to Ashburn in the 1990s. AOL brought fiber and power infrastructure with it. May East, one of the world's first internet exchanges, moved to Loudoun in the late 90s after first forming in 1992.
I mean, it was a couple guys who got together over some beers and decided that they were going to allow one another to pass traffic back and forth across the different networks that they'd been creating.
Other companies followed, each new addition contributing to the growing digital infrastructure. Tech titans like Amazon and Google have a presence here. Northern Virginia's appeal includes reasonably priced land, low-cost but dependable electricity, access to water to cool the equipment, and a skilled, educated population.
The internet itself is really comprised of these peering points that are housed inside data centers. So without data centers, you wouldn't really have the internet.
Data centers provide power, cooling, and connectivity, ensuring that computer applications used by their clients are up and running around the clock.
They want to ensure that all of their customers, wherever they are, can get to it through the internet.
Security is tight. With nondescript exteriors, data centers aren't flashy, but they are very profitable. Loudoun expects to take in $320 million in local tax revenue from data centers this year alone.
Data centers, for every dollar we spend on them, we get about $15 back, which is a great return on our investment.
Dora McCour, VOA News, Ashburn, Virginia.
And this reminder of today's top headline in the United States: Democratic presidential challengers turned their focus Wednesday to the next two party nominating contests, one in the western state of Nevada and the other in the southeastern state of South Carolina, in a marathon chase to pick up party nominee to face Republican President Donald Trump in the November national election. In both states, Democrats will find much more racially diverse electorates than in either of the first nominating contests this month in predominantly white and rural states of Iowa and New Hampshire. Latino and African American voters make up a sizable segment of the electorate in Nevada, home to the country's gambling mecca of Las Vegas. That is VOA Asia for today. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with you again tomorrow. Hope you will as well. Until then, be well.